The lecture of the 28th of October 1916. Rudolf Steiner starts by saying that such a scene in Faust, which we have just witnessed, which leads Faust to the perception of the earth spirit, it can in our time very well release the thought which can attach itself to many of the considerations which we have presented to you in the recent lectures. Faust has in front of himself the earth spirit, and we see that out of the perception of certain things which have been stimulated by the meditation, which was the result of that meditation given him out of the book of Nostradamus, he was transposed into that condition through which it was perceptive to him that which the earth spirit speaks to him. I have indeed over about these things already spoken here, and I will today proceed only from the thought of the earth spirit. Our present age is very quickly finished with such a scene, insofar as for the present type of culture, they repeat for themselves certain convenient formulations. The present time simply says, now indeed, to the poet, he had the fantasy of that which can never be a reality, to make that appear in a magic way, to enchant that before our soul. For Goethe, such a formulation is the peak of everything that's trivial, because for Goethe there existed in all that which he wanted to convey about the relationship of Faust to the earth spirit, there existed a deep, a very significant reality. And how one can now present this reality completely in the sense of Goethe, that's what I want to speak about to you in an introductory way. Goethe was already in the time in which he had written down the scene about the earth spirit. He had very well instructed himself in all that which at that time one could know about certain connections of the human being with the spiritual world. He had carefully orientated himself about that. But if he now more or less had brought these things completely to consciousness, or if he was able to express these in clear words, as we today can speak, upon that is it depends if one takes a consideration upon the time of in which Goethe lived, that doesn't depend. Here Rudolf Steiner is saying it doesn't really matter if he was conscious of it or not. The fact remains is that he has given a very correct perception of the scene. If one wants to follow it in reality, so it can be done in the following way. You must represent to yourself that through that which became for Faust perceptions out of this so-called Book of Nostradamus, in connection with the soul exercises which Faust obviously had earlier made, what happens is that the ether body makes itself free, separates itself partly from the physical body, as it is necessary for a perception of the spiritual world. Through the fact, however, that man in an etheric connection is brought in connection with the external world, and he really experiences the existence, the reality of spiritual beings who are able alone to incorporate themselves in the etheric world, whose embodiment doesn't descend to the physical world. Because Faust experienced the etheric world, he was able to experience those spiritual beings who incorporate themselves in the etheric but do not come down to the physical. This is the situation with that which Goethe represents as the earth spirit, a spiritual being who descends only to the etheric world. So Faust must make himself prepared to be able to perceive the living and weaving of the etheric world in this moment. And this is what he does. Thus we have, it is a playing together of the earth spirit with the etheric, with that etheric body of Faust which has freed itself from the physical body. This is obviously, as I now describe it, something which is a process which is not perceptible for the external sense world, a process which can only be spiritually experienced. Now, in the time which preceded our fifth epoch, the human beings who knew much more than the later human beings about the connection of man with the spiritual world, with those with whom, however, the ancient atavistic capacity more or less had faded away, there was sought for in the different ways for surrogates of a interaction with the spiritual world. Just remember that Faust receives a picture and words out of the book of Nostradamus. Through the fact that he thinks these words, that he forms these thoughts, through that he's able to make a way clear or for his soul the path to the earth spirit. Goethe was permitted to present that because he knew that it corresponded to a reality. In truth, one can say, the time in which the historical Faust had lived was not appropriate for enabling people to experience spiritual connections without further ado. Because earlier, already as the fourth post-fourth epoch, the Greco-Latin culture went to an end with the 14th century. Already at that time, people attempted to get a connection with the spiritual world through surrogates. But these surrogates, of which descriptions are present, can obviously, the present cultured world, the present world looks with ridicule and laughing on these surrogates. But you don't need to listen to these immensely clever people of the present time. You have to make clear to yourself how human beings in whom this capacity had faded away, in whom the capacity was no longer present as earlier, as you have to realize that people at the turning point of the fourth and fifth post-Atlantean period tried through surrogates to make a path for perception of certain spiritual processes which actually could only be perceived in a spiritual way, in a supersense way. And this occurred very, very much through external means. Let's say such a person who attempted to acquire perceptions about the spiritual world and was not able to call up in himself the strong forces in order to perceive purely spiritual these perceptions, he did it in such a way that he took certain substances, he burned these substances, and through a special mixture of quite definite burn combustible substances, the smoke that was called forth was brought into certain movements, which he called forth through quite definite sentences and mantric utterances, which had been communicated to him by tradition. He had magic formulations. Thus, out of certain substances which he burned, he developed a smoke. He spoke into the smoke. He spoke definite sentences which were given to him by tradition, and these could be very similar to the words which Faust found in this book of Nostradamus. He spoke these words into the smoke, and the smoke assumed quite definite forms. If he were able to approach the spiritual world in a pure spiritual way, he wouldn't need to use the smoke. But that, perhaps, he couldn't do. Hence, he spoke into the smoke certain magic formulations. Through such magic formulae, if they are spoken in the correct way, the smoke immediately assumes certain forms. And if the forms were the correct forms, so it was not merely reached that the smoke assumed certain forms, but these forms then gave an opportunity for spiritual beings to enter into his sphere. Spiritual beings who could not enter him in a purely spiritual way. The smoke was, as it were, that which the person formed through his formulae. And the forms which the smoke took, they made it possible through their configuration that the certain spiritual beings of an elementary nature drew into these configurations, into these forms of the smoke, and so were there present. We see it is a surrogate, something through which one could achieve through physical materiality, which one could not achieve in a pure spiritual way. Goethe had avoided presenting such a surrogate. He would have just as well enabled Faust to take another book in which one could put together those herbs which one burned together in order that such a column of smoke could arise, in order that then the earth spirit could enter. This he avoided. He wanted to present the scene in a much more spiritual way. But obviously, Goethe knew of the surrogates. As I told you, people today can laugh about it, that such a thing could have a significance. Now, my dear friends, there is before us something very remarkable. The 19th century has actually arrived at the point of gradually losing all perceptions of the spiritual. Indeed, even the perception of the life force, which is anchored in the life ether. They've lost everything which is anchored in the ether. It is this 19th century, with its materialistic perception, arrived at the point to consider life itself merely as an Ausfluss, as a flowing out of the material, that a living organism was considered, as it were, merely as a complicated machine. Certainly, that existed in the tendency of the 19th century to drive the life out of the perception of things. Now, it is very remarkable that this life, again, after it had been driven out, steals itself into the way of consideration, which again, with the thinking of the 19th and 20th century, up to now, didn't know how to begin with it. It is interesting to observe how one might say that through a door, spirit and life of the investigation was driven out, and from another door there came in, and indeed in a way with which the research didn't know how to manage it. There today think, to be sure, in a real reversed way, certain people contemplate about whether not perhaps they think, well, perhaps that which is not living also lives. Out of the living, one has, so to say, driven out the life. But again, today, people feel impelled to contemplate on the possibility, if possibly, the non-living also lives. One says, for example, that which shows itself as a living nature, and which nevertheless also can have other life laws than the non-living, that has more or less a memory. Now, where everything is thrown together, one ascribes also to plants, to animals, memory. They say that which is living has memory. One wants to make valid this memory as nothing other than something which emanates from a spiritual. One doesn't want to admit that a existence of a memory is connected with a spiritual element. So one attempts to find this memory also in non-living material. How does one do this? Now one says the following. What is memory? Memory consists in the fact that a so-called living being is exposed to a stimulus. And when this living being again is exposed a second time to the same stimulus, then the repetition is such that one notices that the living being already earlier was exposed to the same stimulus. It goes faster with the grasping, with the incorporation of this stimulus. One notices that something remains in the living being, which makes the second time it able to react in a much easier way, in a much faster way than the first time. Now one asks oneself, is that merely a property of a livingness in this way to have a kind of memory? Then one must ascribe to the living special qualities which one does not want to ascribe to it. Thus one can perhaps also with a non-living in a physical stuff also find that it has memory. And there we see, shall we say, a magnet, an iron magnet, which one handles in a certain way so that it is become magnetic, it attracts other iron, and one can, through certain processes with which iron, one can measure the force with which the iron is attracted when the magnet, shall we say, has mediated a certain totality of forces. That one can measure. That one can measure how much one must do in order to magnetize a piece of iron in order to enable it to attract other iron. Now one finds a very interesting fact. Absolute correct facts, one finds that when once one magnetizes iron and through that brings it to a certain force, one waits and then you magnetize it again. Now you require less force in order to apply it to the iron to bring it to the same magnetic force which was the reaction of the first time. And when you do it the third time, you still require less force. Thus, say the people, now you see the magnet, you can find in the magnet the existence of memory, which also exists in higher complicated beings. And the same sort of thing you can prove in other forces which attach themselves to non-living substances. For example, when you deform a completely elastic body, one can deform it through the application of a certain force. Then it returns back to its original size. And in the returning back, in the coming back to its original form, it develops a certain force of reaction, which has a definite strength. And one can measure this strength through apparatus. You find the second time you don't need to apply such a strong force in order that you get a similar elasticity and to unfold itself again. And so one can say that also in the grasping of forces of elasticity, the non-living beings are attached with the non-living beings, you have a certain type of memory. Now this sort of thought processes is very remarkable. Of animals, one does not want to assume that they have a special force of memory, because with them you have driven out the spiritual life. Now it steals itself into, insofar as you take magnets or an elastic body, thus non-living things, and you ascribe them with memory. But one has gone much further. One indeed finds a special characteristic of living beings. As you know, in the shadow side of living beings, there's always a possibility of becoming ill. Now one again asks the question, is it not possible to have non-living things to become ill? And there, certain people were very, very happy who, so to say, want to drive the existence of livingness out of life, that they were in a position of being able to show, indeed, the non-living people, non-living elements, can also be ill. To being ill is not just a privilege of living elements, but even non-living elements can be ill. There was a chemist named Erdmann who first noticed in certain pieces of tin in the structure that this tin showed quite remarkable phenomena. Such a piece of tin could get bubbles, which in this way are expanded, and underneath that it's hollow. And when you press these bubbles in, underneath the tin is dust, is powdery. There was a sort of powder at that place. And see, that goes farther. We have things, information which confirm the fact that it didn't remain, these observations didn't remain merely with Erdmann. But we find the following description, for example. Thus, after Erdmann, the chemist Dr. Fritzsche, who occupied himself with this illness of tin, when the chief of a merchandising house in St. Petersburg told him that whole blocks of pure metals which were sent by ship actually fell to pieces. This happened in the winter, that also the buttons of uniform changed themselves into a grey powder. And so Fritzsche came to the thought that perhaps the excessive cold had affected the tin. And recently, Professor Dr. Ernst Cohen of the Van Toff Laboratory of the University of Utrecht has investigated similar phenomenon and said here we're dealing with an infection illness of the metals. And the most remarkable thing is that when you took this powder and just put it on your finger and then put the powder on another piece of tin, which was quite good, so this tin is infected by the same illness. From all this you can see that in future there'll be not only doctors for human beings, doctors for animals, but there'll also be doctors for metals. Thus, we've discussed that you know that people say that living things have perception, that living things do not only have memory, and not only do they have the capacity of becoming ill, but living things also have the capacity for sensation, for perception. Now people have discovered that not only living things can perceive noise, but something which is not living can also have a perception for noise. A column of smoke can perceive noise, and through the noise can change its form. Thus, these modern physicists ascribe to the column of smoke a capacity for sensation. But they've forgotten all the formulations about the ancient magicians who have spoken into columns of smoke in order to bring a certain configuration to the smoke. John Tyndall, an ordinary physicist of our present age, of our fifth post-Atlantean period, observes how a column of smoke is disturbed by a noise, it can dance to music, and it can have certain shapes when you recite certain verses of Spenser to it. But these observations were given not only to a column of smoke, but also to a stream of water. And John Tyndall writes in his book that the sensitivity of this stream of water is amazing. It can really be similar to the way we hear with our ear. But still further, a certain person named LeConte has in America, when you had a musical soiree, he made a remarkable discovery. He says that after the music began, he notices that the flame begins to show vibrations. The gas flame showed vibrations, which conformed itself to the music itself, and this phenomenon can be observed particularly when the strong tones of the cello added themselves. Thus, he observed the flame, how it hears musical sounds, and it imitates a sound in its own form. It's also noticed that the electrical arc lamp reacts in a very fine way to sound. In fact, one thought of using this phenomenon in order for telephonic communication. Now, I have a comment here. As a matter of fact, Rudolf Steiner gave Schiller, Paul Eugen Schiller, certain recommendations of using a gas flame in order to be able to use it for recording sounds instead of the mechanical way, instead of the electrical way of recording sounds. Instead of using tape recorders, he recommended experiments to be made in Dornach by using the sensitivity of the gas flame and to use that for transmission. I thought of just mentioning that as a side issue here. Now, because these investigators are so materialistic, they can do nothing else but interpret these things in a materialistic way. So naturally they say, now indeed, if the non-living also can have sensation, if the non-living also can become ill, if the non-living also can develop memory, then you don't have to ascribe anything special to living things. You can assume, therefore, The living thing is only a much more complicated non-living thing. Since, my dear friends, it is a very characteristic of this 19th century, right into our own days, that, as it were, that one cannot really meet the fullness and multiplicity and manifoldness of the phenomena, you can't really come to terms with them with the thoughts which they have at their disposal. All the thoughts which they use, one can say, shows their helplessness. On one hand, all the manifold phenomena which have been investigated seem to demand that they should expand their amplitude of thinking, even though the phenomena themselves demand that, yet there is a helplessness involved here. They do not want to approach the science of the spirit in order to learn from it. They'd rather remain in their helplessness in confronting these situations. And there it's most interesting to consider certain tendencies of our age. One will be able to understand them when one is able to put them in the light which has been presented to you in the lectures of the previous weeks. You just keep in mind the problems which the theology of all the religious confessions have when they try to come to terms with the results of natural science, and they are placed in a sort of turmoil. In ancient times, in previous times, and not very far back, not so long ago, theology expressed certain truths. Truths, among other truths, truths about the spiritual worlds, but also truths about the human soul. And these truths, one doesn't need to attack. We know indeed how precisely, through spiritual scientific research, the truths which traditionally theology has taken over can be confirmed. But the theologians themselves do not, in the main, permit themselves to get some sort of a harmony with that which storms into it from the natural scientific world conception. They find that not convenient. And so it happens that the theologians express their words according to the old truths, but the object of it is taken into claim by natural science. Now let's see what he's talking about here. Natural science arrives and places its things about the human soul, acts of the human soul, and takes away the object, the soul, from theologians. The theologians talk still about the soul, but they haven't the object. Rufstein is simply saying here that whereas in previous times the theology were the experts on the human soul, now natural science has come along and taken away from the soul from them, and now natural science are the experts. That's what Rufstein is saying here. This is typical of an example. There you have a theologian. He gives lectures, a whole cycle of lectures, first about natural scientific world conception or about the configuration of life. Then he gives lectures about ethical problems, then about aesthetic problems. And then he discusses how he arrives at his Christianity. First he speaks of the natural scientific world conception. Then he says to regard the human being as a being of nature, we leave that over to natural scientific way of thinking. The man of nature, we leave over to natural science. But the man of freedom, we leave over to the religious considerations. It would be bad for theologians if they will not permit natural science to have their complete right. You should let natural science have their complete right. Just divide the human being up into two, give over the man of nature to the science of nature, and leave man of freedom to theology. In this way, you can throw a compromise, conclude a compromise. An example of this is the father gives two children a piece of bread and tells one of them to divide it up. One of the children says, "How shall I divide it up?" And the father says, "Divide it up in a real Christian way." Then the child asks, "How does one divide up in Christian?" "You said, well, you divide it up, you keep the smaller portion for yourself and give your brother the larger portion." Then the child replies, "In that case, let him do the dividing. Let the other boy do the dividing." Now, when theologians came along and said, "Let's divide up man, let natural science have the man of nature, and let us have the man of freedom," that's the way they divide it. And how is man divided as far as man of a nature? You find the following. Man, in Rudolf Steiner's quoting now, he says, "Man, as he meets us in zoology, is a two-legged being. He walks vertical, a finely developed spinal column and brain, and this man is just as good as any, just like any other part of organic or inorganic structures. He's a portion of nature. He's constructed out of the same mass, out of the same energies, of the same atoms, of the same forces which go through the rest of nature. Doesn't matter how complicated man, the body of man may be, in his whole putting together, it is ordered in conformity to law as all other living and unliving beings of nature. In this way, there's no difference between what will be man put together and a corn of sand, piece of sand, a grain of sand. The soul functions, which are accessible to natural scientific contemplation, at the basis of that, at the basis of the soul functions, there's just a strong conformity to law as the bodily processes. And the perceptions which we have, as well as the ideas which we form, are just as compelled to us by nature as the nerve processes which lead us to experience pleasure and pain. The soul is just as based on mechanical processes as a steam engine." This are the sort of lectures you hear from theologians. But nevertheless, this theologian retains the human being, the man of freedom. In a goodwill way, he gives up the man of nature, but he retains the man of freedom. But when you investigate the thing, you discover that the man of nature, investigated by natural science, is robbed of his freedom. So what does a theologian do? He's holding back the man of freedom. But the man of freedom loses his freedom with the man of nature. So really, the theologian holds nothing back in reality. He's given everything over to the natural scientist. But you may respond, such a theologian is an honest man. So you can say in the words of Shakespeare, "Brutus is a noble man. So are they all noble people." So from all this you can see that people today have not grown up to manage the manifold storm of facts which are approaching us. That which people today lack, that's the capacity to be able to dominate the totality of facts which life offers them, to dominate that with thoughts. The thoughts are not able to do anything with it. This intellectual theologian shows that he simply can't think. This, however, is a main characteristic of our age, the complete absence of the thinking capacity. Nevertheless, this theologian is a noble man, and he means everything in a good connection. So he continues by saying that materialism has inserted itself deeply in our age, and it must be different. Then he begins to think about the materialistic of the age, about sportism, comfortism, mammonism. He ends his lecture by saying that mankind can only be saved by going away from materialism. He publishes all these 12 lectures in a book, and he says the content of this book consists out of 12 lectures which I gave last winter to more than 1,000 people. So you see, the most crippled, corrupted type of thinking proceeds from the privileged places, because it's one of the most well-known theologians of the present time who spoke what I just told you about. And people don't seem to notice these things, and you can see the evil of the present time in which people are not thoughtful enough to go to the root of things. So the poor sheep listen to such theologians, and they believe that because those are theologians, they're giving them spiritual food, and they're taking into their soul what the modern science has produced, the modern time has produced. Only the most extreme brutality, even if it's an unconscious brutality, emanates from such a complete lack of self-consciousness, and has been caused by an unconscious misuse of the power of offices. And it would be quite false, my dear friends, if you were to confront these things with a ostrich-like burying your head in the sand. Because if you do that, you will never be able to take up the correct impulses which one can take up from spiritual science, so which can then in a constructive way work into the progress of the cultural development of our age. I know many people sitting here today will consider that I'm exaggerating, that I'm merely giving isolated examples, but it's not true. I can give you many more examples, and this is not an exaggeration. It's something that emanates if you approach our age with a sharpened glance, because by the side of such an intellectual misuse of the thinking power, there is also the moral aberration. For from such corners there sounds out the opposition against spiritual science, which has the hearing of thousands and tens of thousands. Can one believe that people who in this way are not able to think, are they in a position in any way of being able to evaluate a spiritual science? Hence it's no wonder when one also hears such voices about spiritual science as has appeared quite recently. I'll just mention one which characterizes the way things are done. There are two writings, one from a priest named R, and if you compare the lecture with which this priest R made with my lecture which I gave in January in Liestal, you will see the sort of rubbish that this priest spoke. After this priest says all sorts of nonsense about anthroposophy, then he says, "We recognize now," he's quoting now, "we recognize now in which sense precisely Dr. Steiner has come to the assertion that we are not against Christianity, we are actually the real Christians. Christ was, in the eyes of the anthroposophist, such a person who was able to perceive the higher forces, the higher mights. Dr. Steiner, the teacher, will also believe that he perceives these higher beings and partakes of these higher beings. That also every one of us can participate in this higher, in perceiving these higher forces if we do the correct exercises with the correct persistence. So it again then comes to the demand which was mentioned by the Russian mystic Solovyov, who says, we are all and we all can be Christians. And so we have every mystic who is so friendly can take consideration of Christianity. I don't understand what he's talking about. Anyway, ancient wisdom in a new garment. Now, Rudolf Steiner continues. After quoting something which this priest said, Rudolf Steiner says that he's saying the actual reverse of what represents the nerve of our spiritual science in relationship to Christianity. Here this priest has in front of him this lecture which I've given, and that's what he says about it. Dr. Steiner says that everybody by exercises can do just what Christ did. Now here you see the sort of moral turpitude that people have got into. This priest actually said that Rudolf Steiner follows the mystical path, but as far as we are concerned, we cannot give up the demands of the human thinking which the mystics want us to do. And you see the sort of moral turpitude there. Ladies and gentlemen, go through all my lectures, all my writings, and you'll see how little I'm insisting upon the giving up of thinking. So people place before the public just the reverse, and they have thousands of listeners. They accuse spiritual science of the very thing that spiritual science does not do. And here ends the lecture.